This is By Design right here on RN. Fenella Kernebone with you. Coming up today, another take on beauty in design and the craze for pop-ups. So you might remember when to pop up somewhere usually meant popping up to a friend's house to say hi. Well, today, more often than not, it refers to a pop-up space. Whether it's a design store, a fashion shop, or even a temporary bar, transient architecture, that's the topic of today's panel. And we are also in Brisbane to visit a family home in the burbs, but with a domestic plan that challenges the conventional layout of most homes.
There are no walls. This is another thing. Why no walls?
It gives a delightful sense of openness, and there's a number of curtains that we use as opposed to walls. Just open it all up, and I guess what it gives us is a feeling and a sense of bringing the outdoors inside and the inside outdoors. It's a very grey area. What's inside, what's outside.
And you'll hear more about this wall-less house when By Design heads in the field. But now I want you to look around your home. Look at the things that you use every single day, your computer, your mobile phone, even your toothbrush. How much does the way it looks impact on your decision to buy it? Car makers constantly tout their vehicles as having great fuel efficiency or all other kinds of technologies that makes the inner workings of the car function better than, let's say, any other vehicle. The things that we often can't see. But if you don't like the look of it, would you spend all that money buying it? Most wouldn't. Ross Dawson is a futurist, an author, and also a speaker, and believes that we expect more and more from our products. Not only do we want things to work, but we expect beauty. But beauty is a little bit more than simply aesthetics. So, Ross Dawson, welcome to By Design.
My pleasure to be with you.
You say that the primary driver of social change is our growing expectations, that we want more and more on every front. What are we wanting more of, Ross?
Well, just about anything you can imagine. From opportunity is one of the basic expectations we have. We want more transparency. We want more to participate more. We want better education. We also want what I frame as excellence. I think we have an expectations of excellence in everything around us, and one of the emerging aspects of that is an increasing expectation that the things around us are beautiful. And I think this ties in beautifully, as it were, with the theme of design, where design is about merging the function and the aesthetics. And in this century, the 21st century being, I think, very aptly being described as the century of design, this beauty is becoming more and more to the fore of our expectations across all fronts.
Okay, can you unpack a bit more about what that means? Let's start with this notion of excellence. What do you really mean from that idea?
It's excellence encompasses many things. I think the first thing is that we are becoming more discerning. So as humans, we have five senses, and in the past, we have been satisfied with food that tasted okay and that things that felt all right and things that looked okay. But the discernment is this ability to distinguish the differences between tastes, for example. So it's not that long ago that in Australia, a stubby was all people wanted. Now we are all becoming awenophiles with more and more distinguished palates, able to discern the distinctions between different grape varietals and the ages and where they come from. We are able to distinguish and discern between the thread counts of sheets or the clothes that we wear or other people wear in terms of the quality of the senses that we perceive. So we are, as we becoming more and more discerning, we can distinguish between what is not just good, but is truly excellent and stands out.
Okay. So, and this is where this expectation, this growth or this evolution, this in this expectation of beauty comes into it. So can tell us a bit more about what that beauty actually is, and to you?
Part of it is a visual beauty. So, for example, if we're looking, you described at the beginning some of the things around us, from toothbrushes to cars, and there is an aesthetic function in, you know, looking at these things and saying they look beauty. But I think there is also a beauty in the way in which function as aesthetics are married together. So, for example, we have the ability to have design which is beautiful in how it is created, in the elegance of, for example, having very little waste. So we can start to see products that are efficient in how they work, and there is a beauty in that design as well as in the aesthetic of the beauty that we see. I think one specific thing, domain, is that of technology, where I always characterize that it was instructive to see that the early computers, personal computers, were almost all beige, arguably the ugliest color in existence. And in the turning point was, in fact, in 1998 when Apple released its iMac series in a whole series of special colors. Before then, Apple had actually gone along with everyone else. They had just as ugly cases to their computers as anyone else. It was that then people woke up. They were shown something that was attractive in technology. Today, it's a vast difference than it was before. People expect all of the technology we use to be beautiful as well as functional.
And in the example of the iMac, as you said, it gave us different colours, but also it made us understand computers so that it wasn't frightening. So they even had a handle on it so you could pick it up and carry it around. Before that, you couldn't do that as well. And that leads into, I imagine, the other manufacturers, the computers, the technology, starting to have to adopt those sorts of changes to be beautiful to us as consumers. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's interesting to unpack as to whether this is led by consumers demanding this or whether it is the introduction of new products which raise those expectations. I think, in fact, particularly in the case of technology, it has been the introduction of the new technology where people say, wow, this is great, this is different, this is fantastic, and now I expect this from all other manufacturers. So Apple has clearly been one of the leaders, though we're starting to see Samsung and others start to create products, technology products of beauty, and which means that simply that all other manufacturers have to follow suit. This is now the expectations have been raised. As soon as we find something that is better than we've had before, we expect that across the board.
The fact is, of course, though, Ross, in that there is so much technology out there, of course, with the development of technology. I mean, you can fit a microchip. I mean, 60 years ago, a computer used to take up an entire football field practically. Now it can fit, on a corner of my little finger. So things are getting better and better, but we are deluged with access to gadgets and things like that. So that discernment that you talk about there when it comes to technology, how does that come into this conversation when it comes particularly to technology? You mentioned before more sustainable practice, things like that.
As I said, part of the beauty isn't simply the aesthetic. You can look at something and say, that looks attractive, that is well designed. I think it is interesting to put this in the world of media, where, for example, we have moved from, I think we can say safely that newspapers in the past were ugly. And they weren't well designed, I believe, for many reasons. Yet we're starting to see that now the role of the journalist, for example, is that of designing visually attractive ways for people to be able to see and digest and to understand information, the relationship between companies and politicians and so on. So this is partly a way for a more beautiful and aesthetic way to understand information and to relate to that. And technology is largely this interface to information. It's interface to the connections that we have. So the more that we can design effective interfaces, the more that we, this is all a manifestation, I believe, of essentially beauty.
Okay. Here on By Design, I am speaking to Ross Dawson. He is my guest today. He is a futurist, an author, and also a speaker. And we are considering the role of beauty in the things that we use. And of course, that are sort of our expectations that go along with that as well. You talk about lead users, that we can sort of dictate what we want by making beautiful choices for better made products, for effective interfaces as well. Who are these lead users?
So in innovation, if you look at corporate innovation, one of the most important concepts is that of user-generated innovations. No longer companies that create things and then push them out. They look to their users for the ideas on how they do that, and particularly to what are called lead users, who are the most advanced in being able to find new ways of using things, or are the most sophisticated, or indeed, and most importantly, the most discerning. So the companies must focus on those of those customers or potential customers who are the most discerning, who can pick out the quality, who can make a choice based on aesthetics, who can see a more elegant design and choose that. So this, the part of what companies are doing now is being able to reach out to find, to discover, to build communities in particular of these lead users, the most sophisticated, the most discerning users, to be able to find out what their ideas are, but also how they respond to the possibilities we have.
And how are companies finding these lead users, these lead people? You know, am I one? Are you one? Who are they?
More and more this is happening in communities through social networks. So we can discover the most sophisticated, you know, graphic designers start to gravitate to each other. We can, the whole world, connected world and the social networks, one of the things that really offers us is to find like-minded people as never before. We were bound by geography before. Now we can find those people who are like-minded. And what we are starting to see on social networks is this gravitation of these most discerning, most sophisticated people in clusters where they have conversations about things, they debate things, they discuss things. So by far the most propitious place to be able to find these people are when they have found themselves, each other, and the conversations they engage with. That is where you can find these, not individually, but indeed a community of these who self-select each other and the people they engage with.
And the companies find it by going to these social networks, these sites, to engage with these users. How do they do that without, I'm feeling a bit cynical here, how do you actually find them?
Well, I would have to say that it is only the better companies that are really doing this and doing this well, but this is where they are. This is where the best way to do that. Other ways are to be able to, you do folk, there's
myriad many, of ways.
Yeah, myriad ways of doing it. And I only see at the moment a minority of companies that are actually going into the people who connect. And the only way to identify those people is to be one of those yourselves. You can't sort of, as you say, be, if you are going in with a cynical, highly profit motive perspective when you're going in, then you're unlikely to be accepted or to be able to engage with those people. You have to be one of them in a way to be able to go in. So companies need to have people inside who are, again, those most discerning people, the ones who relate to those lead users, who can have the meaningful conversation with them in order to be able to say, yes, I'd be interested in bouncing some ideas around. And this is the way in which business is going, is this business is more and more based on community. And the ability for businesses to engage in community means they have to be minded. How do we create value for this small pool of extremely discerning people who aesthetes who believe in beauty? How can we connect to engage with them? This is the kind of mentality that we're starting to see from a few of the better companies today.
Mm. And I mean, it's quite complex, but quite extraordinary stuff, I must say, Ross. As you say, these lead users looking for quality, paying more for beauty, making better choices. There is you were giving me a great example the other day about the big ocean patch of plastic in the Pacific Ocean, a choice there to make great decisions, great beautiful design decisions to solve a really significant problem. What was that example, and why is that significant as an idea of beauty to you?
There's actually a number of variations on this, but essentially robots that gather plastic in the ocean and come together to create things that are useful, islands on which things can happen, or products that are valuable from them. And I think this is a part of a broader frame. If we think about the future of humanity, an observation about today, of humans today, is we waste so much. It is, you know, a primary characteristic of humanity today. And if we look at our future, there is no question that we need to waste less. So I would think it is not just elegant and functional, but it is actually truly beautiful to be able to create something which either takes things which are waste or actually creates no waste. So, for example, these robots which seek out things that have been discarded and from those create things that are utilitarian, and indeed they can in fact be fueled, their fuel, their power can be drawn from the rubbish that they retrieve.
So these are great examples of elegance and beauty. And something that we will see, I imagine, and I do hope more of in the future. Ross Dawson, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. Great to have a chat with you here on By Design.
It's a real pleasure.
Ross Dawson there, my guest, and a futurist, an author, also a speaker, chairman of AHT Group, many other things. You can find some links on By Design's website. Coming up next, Jan Ryan takes a trip to a house in the suburbs where the yard, which we might normally think of as the backyard, is actually in the centre of the house. So let's call it an in-yard.
It's home loan season and the big four banks are spruiking their wares with refreshed marketing campaigns.
From using scenes from The Wizard of Oz, Jaws, Gremlins and a finalist from The Voice, what are the messages they want us to hear?
Also, ever noticed how many words in computer culture are derived from the natural world?
Clouds, streams, torrents, viruses and bugs.
Could it be technobiophilia?
That's the list online at the RN website.
You're listening to By Design here on RN with Fenella Kernebone.
And let's be in Brisbane right now. We're going to Bisley Place House, which is a family home and it's in the suburbs. Now, when I say suburbs, that might make you think of backyards, cluttered driveways, roller door garages and a big old barbecue. You know, that cliched image of the regular 3 to 4 bedroom home. And while Bisley Place House is a family home and it's on a regular suburban street, it twists all the traditional conventions, but within the council's building codes. This surprising house is a U-shape, it's made of brick and it's wrapped around an internal lawn. But, and here is one of the twists, there is a series of 4 see-through mesh garage doors that make up the front wall of the house facing the street. And if you want to get a sense of what this looks like, we've got some images on our website. Have a look while you're listening to this story, where By Design's Jan Ryan joins architect James Russell and his client, the owner of the house, Wayne Timms.
We had quite a lot of chats about the kitchen being out on the street front. So that Wayne, as the main person who cooks and controls the house, could see what the kids are doing when they're running up and down on the street and mixing with neighbours. Mm. But also the street is the north side of the house. So by taking out the front fence, instead of having a fairly useless 6-metre strip of land, suddenly it becomes about 12 metres wide in this case. So it's a big garden that they open onto. And then beyond that is a very quiet street that becomes their cricket pitch, the place to ride bikes, etc.
Literally, the kitchen is pretty much straight onto the garden and the street. You've got some bubbly grass here. I've never seen this.
It's called zoysia grass, and it's basically no-mow grass. And it just gives a different textural feel, I suppose, to the traditional lawn. We planted lots and lots of little 100mm pots, and over the last couple of years, it's sort of all meshed into a lawn. It always gets a comment, which is good.
It certainly does. I feel as if I'm walking into something quite radical because we're walking straight through the front of the house. There's 4 garage doors and that's the front of the house and they're open and in we go.
A nice thing about this whole series, the whole front of the house being garage doors, is it's like a gate. You're not closed off from the street. You can sit behind and be protected a certain amount of privacy. But with the push of a button, you're able to open up completely to the north and to the street again.
We're completely opened up today. Now we're walking in through the kitchen. You are a stay-at-home dad because yep. Lisa, your wife, is working and you've got 2 young children. How do they cope with this freedom and openness?
I guess they've grown up with it, so that's they don't know anything different. I'd probably rephrase the question and say, how do they cope when they don't get it?
There are no walls. This is another thing. Why no walls?
It gives a delightful sense of openness, and there's a number of curtains that we use as opposed to walls. I think there's a washing machine. That's the way we really like it. Just open it all up, and I guess what it gives us is a feeling and a sense of bringing the outdoors inside and the inside outdoors. It's a very grey area. What's inside, what's outside?
Who knows? Do you want to fix the washing machine? This is what happens. You can hear everything in this house. It's wonderful. Very interesting acoustics. I can see some curtains. And they look beautiful in the breeze.
But you can also slide large sets of doors across to make the lounge or the dining indoors. So to design or make it so it's still comfortable through winter was very important.
This is By Design on RN. I'm Jan Ryan and I'm in Brisbane with architect James Russell and client Wayne Timms. And we're looking through the incredible house in the suburbs, images on the website. We've just walked off the internal garden and we're now in the playroom.
Here is a second patio. The front patio is for dining. And then the second one back here is kids' play space, first and foremost. So they have this large protected veranda that opens straight to the north, out to lawn. And they can run back and forth as much as they like all day. Mm. But what's been nice is the girls get in here and they do see it like a cubby house. So in winter, they draw that curtain around, and occasionally in summer as well, when they just want a little bit of to be hidden away, the curtain gives them the same sort of qualities as a cubby house as well.
There's actually nowhere to hide. Wayne, why? Why not? And does it matter?
No. I didn't want a series of places where the family could disseminate to. I wanted our family to grow up together and to interact together. For good or bad, it forces the occupants of the house to interact with each other.
So how's that brought the family together? What have you gained that you can see and describe from that?
I think it's been in each other's presence, I think is the other way of putting it as well. I think that's the really wonderful part about the house is that it doesn't matter where you are, we're all together.
The other very striking thing about the house is that it seems to have no ceiling. It looks unfinished.
Getting back to everything being on display, I think a nice thing is that what we've been walking through so far, you can see. So the really public parts of the house, the living, the meals, where you come together, you can see, especially when the curtains are pushed back. But there's a whole part of the house that allows Wayne and Lisa and the kids to retreat. So the more cave-like spaces, whether it be the bedrooms or this whole attic space, this piece that wraps around within the trusses of the roof. And that's also where, I guess, a lot of storage happens, but also the girls have lots of books. Wayne has his guitars. So there are these pieces that allow you to hide in the house.
Okay. Can we go there?
Yes.
So we're now up the stairs and we're in the attic, which is a completely different experience.
It came from a number of chats about storage, first of all.
Is this something you asked for, or is this something that came out of the discussion with the architect, with James?
This is straight out of James Russell's brain. I distinctly remember the discussion about wanting some space in the roof. He said, yeah, it's not a bad idea. Next set of drawings, we had this enormous space.
It is enormous. It's like a huge corridor around the top of the house, which you can't see from the street, or you don't even know it's there when you're downstairs.
And when it was being built, it was almost, well, still is probably my favourite part of the house outside of the kitchen. It just gives you an interaction with all the materials that are involved, the wood, the brick, the steel. It's all here on show. It's a bit of the heart of the house. It's got a bit of soul up here. I really like it.
Do you need permission to come up here?
Well, it's a bit like the Bat Cave. You will have to look into the special device that makes you forget you were here.
I mean, you could come up here and just walk up and down and it you wouldn't know that anyone... Oh, wow, little cupboards. Didn't even know they were there. That's very clever. Who would know that that's your wardrobe?
Well, it's just a bit of extra space.
Extra
wardrobe, yeah. That's probably my fault. I have probably more clothes than my wife.
Well, we're just walking completely around this house.
I think depth to a house or layers within a house are really important. If it was purely about the very public side of the house, they wouldn't have that ability to retreat or hide away or dream and make their own little part of the house that no one else knows about.
Oh, definitely. We're so close to the roof here that you can hear the birds walking across the roof. So where would you go from here if you were ever to leave?
I'd struggle. A tent. This is as close to outdoors as you can get, I think. I'd rather not give James that challenge.
All right. Thank you, Wayne.
You're welcome.
Thanks, James.
Thank you very much.
Architect James Russell and client Wayne Timms there. And do have a look at some of the images. They are on our website at abc.net.au/radionational. Now, this fascinating family house is a finalist in the 2013 Australian Institute of Architects National Awards. That is being announced next week. And it also recently won the AIA's 2013 Robin Dodds Awards for the best residential house in Queensland. Coming up soon here on By Design, how is temporary or transient design transforming how you live, how you interact, how you even shop? We're talking about pop-ups in the panel. But now let's hear from writer Colin Bissett as he takes a look at the much-coveted Italian scooter, the Vespa.
The best-selling motorcycle in the world is the Honda Super Cub, but the most stylish is surely the Vespa. As Italian as espresso, this tiny-engined scooter made its appearance in 1946 as Italy struggled to put itself back together after the disaster of the Second World War. The brainchild of Enrico Piaggio, it arose like a phoenix from the ashes of the old Piaggio aeronautic factory in Tuscany that had been not only bombed by the Allies, but destroyed by the retreating Germans. Enrico was of a pragmatic nature and decided that what Italy now needed was a cheap mode of transport. Without the resources to create a car, he came up with a prototype motor scooter that was nicknamed Paperino, or Donald Duck, by the factory workers because of its strange appearance. Piaggio's designer, Corradino D'Ascagno, hated it and came up with a more streamlined, practical model, which Piaggio exclaimed looked like a wasp, una Vespa. The name stuck. The aeronautic background to the machine is evident in the streamlined shape. This was not a traditional motorcycle, but something new. Its fat little 8-inch wheels, broad metal leg shields, and a step-through design made it look as though it was hovering above the ground. With a buzzy 98cc engine and a single cylinder, it could reach a top speed of 60 kilometres an hour, perfect for weaving through the medieval streets of Italy. Faster models followed with larger wheels and a longer seat able to accommodate two in relative comfort. By 1956, the single headlamp was transferred from the front wheel guard to the middle of the handlebars. The scooter continued to evolve, with tough racing versions that found favour with the mod gangs of 1960s England. It also formed the basis of the ubiquitous three-wheeled truck, the Ape, which first appeared in 1947 and which was further developed into the tuk-tuk taxi, so familiar on the roads of Southeast Asia. The most popular wasp on the planet, perhaps.
Colin Bissett there, being stylish with the Vespa motor scooter. It makes me think, I used to ride one back in the day. I'm feeling very nostalgic now.
Your say.
Jan Ryan talks with me now, as always, about your comments, your responses, your say, in fact. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Fenella.
We're talking about trends, of course, childhood toys, creativity, lots of great responses this week.
We are indeed. And Philip Drew, who's an architecture writer, a much respected architecture writer, he wrote, in the program last week, October 12, you interviewed two New Zealand academics, Robert and Brenda Vale, on construction toys, but you missed a great opportunity to talk about the role of play as a catalyst for creativity. Frank Lloyd Wright was given Froebel blocks to play with by his mother. And when using these blocks, he developed what you could see in his more mature designs later on, the triangular, circular, orthogonal base designs that Frank Lloyd Wright is famous for.
Then in the 1970s, while I was a lecturer in architecture at the University of Queensland, as an experiment, I introduced Spiel-Naef blocks made in Switzerland and very much in the Bauhaus mode in an introductory first-year design course. These are beautifully crafted timber cubes and rods. For the first 6 weeks, when I entered the studio, the only sound was of collapsing blocks. All my first-year students could think of was building the highest towers, higher than any other students, a compulsion that seems very prevalent in entrepreneurs and developers today. My students failed to explore the full range of range made possible by each set of blocks. I then realised that 12 years of primary and secondary education had more or less stifled their creativity.
Mm.
And, he adds, all the waves in their hair had been straightened. Oh. It's just a nice aside. And really what Philip's saying here is that it's really important to play. This is part of making you a really bigger architect and designer and scientist and all things, but in this case, architect.
Absolutely, to play. So you go and buy some blocks, see what happens. Yeah. Don't have to go high, though.
No, but what do you think about straightening one's hair?
Don't, exactly. Stephen Kites writes in on the same subject, Jan, and he says that the program brought back many happy memories. I had a box of the Richter's block my parents had bought me secondhand. I loved playing with them for some years, even though some of the blocks were broken. And as a result, I couldn't build anything close to the buildings that were featured in the accompanying pages. Years later, I had an Erector set, which is comparable to Meccano, and with it built whatever I could imagine, bridges, I love this, Ferris wheels, cars. I even had an electric motor, which was no little batteries, basically. Apparently, it was 110V AC, if that makes sense. So, yeah, thankfully, I kept the Erector set. Thank you so much, Stephen Coates, for writing in.
And Linda Clifford writes, the very mention of mini bricks took me straight back to my childhood in London in the 50s, where I spent many happy hours playing with these little plastic bricks. Also wondering if any listeners remember Floral Gardens from the same era.
And here is a comment that was dropped on By Design's phone from a listener with an observation of the trend in modern cars to have a big boot.
It's June Mills. The reverse parking, when you're parallel parking, one of the biggest problems is the cars that are designed to full-bodied back, whereas a car with a boot, you can see over the boot, and so that you're not half a car onto the road before you can see whether there's oncoming cars. Yeah, designed with the full-bodied back is a real pest.
Okay, thank you very much to our listener for that comment. What do you think as well, if you're listening right now, are our cars' backsides getting too big, too gargantuan? What do you think? Do you like this design trend? You can let us know on our Facebook page, on our website, or any other kind of avenue. You can find all those details on the By Design website. Thank you very much, Jan.
Thanks, Fenella.
See you again next week. And, of course, keep those comments coming in. Coming up next, though, here on By Design, the panel is taking a look at pop-up spaces. We're also exploring the idea that maybe we can all be placemakers. We're talking about our streets, I suppose, and I thought that would be a good opportunity to play Peter Gabriel and his song called Mercy Street.
Looking down on empty streets, all she can see are the dreams all made solid, are the dreams made real. All of the buildings and all of the cars were once just a dream in somebody's head. She pictures the broken glass, pictures the steam. She pictures a soul with no leak at the seams. Wait until darkness. Wait until darkness comes. Nowhere in the corridors of pale green and grey. Nowhere in the suburbs, in the cold light of day.
An absolutely gorgeous song, Peter Gabriel there, and his song called Mercy Street. Fenella Kernebone with you. This is By Design. Now, have you ever bought wares from a pop-up business that wasn't there yesterday and guess what? Won't be there next month? Maybe it was a disused store on the main street or a shipping container in a car park. or perhaps you've been lured to have a drink at one of those beautifully designed pop-up bars in an empty lot somewhere in your city. For a long time, we have associated architecture with permanence. We talk about monuments that stand the test of time, buildings that are fixed. And while that idea may never lose its shine, something else has fast gained traction, the pop-up. So how does the pop-up or temporary and transient design continually transform our urban landscapes, where those boundaries between architecture, art, design and social interventions have become blurred? A big topic today, and I'm joined by my guests, Peter Edwards, an architect, urbanist and the director of Archipelago, a Brisbane-based architecture and urban design practice. Welcome to you, Peter.
Hi there.
Matt Tobin joins me too, who is the principal of Urban Art Projects, a specialist design agency that delivers art and creativity for the public realm. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
And Amy Gray, a landscape architect at Meter Design and the owner of Vibrant Places, and also the current Queensland Emerging Designer of the Year. Welcome, Amy.
Hi.
Peter Edwards, you are passionate about the idea that we can all be city makers and create the city of our dreams. I like that idea. How do pop-ups play into this for you? What role do they play?
I think that pop-ups are a kind of bellwether for a changing idea about that we all have about embracing our cities. When typically I in my professional life use that word, use that idea that we can all be city makers, I'm typically talking to a boardroom full of big-handed bureaucrats who are rolling out billions and billions of bucks worth of transport infrastructure. And whilst I think it's this idea that we're just going to get our city kind of handed to us and is something that we just have to inherit, I think that there's a lot of indicators to show that that sense of taking back the city is something that we can claim for ourselves and make into to more closely align with our hopes and aspirations for the kind of urbanity that we'd like to enjoy. I think that the pop-up phenomena and small spaces, the laneway rejuvenations, those are kind of early indicators of a deeper cultural change to a better appreciation for living in cities.
So they're interrupting the more traditional ideas of urban planning, where we are actually reclaiming that job of being the city maker, the urban planner as such. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Very much. I mean, I think that the idea that we can all be city makers starts with the simple notion of planting some of your garden on the other side of your fence, which begins to engage you in the street, which is your first foray into public realm. But Brisbane is a new city, and when we are building a new city, we should, by virtue of the fact we have all of history to be learning from, be building one of the very best cities in the world. And that goes to many of the emerging cities around Australia. Perth in the Gold Coast are very good examples. Yet we're still doomed to board the aeroplane and suffer the long journeys to visit those cities made famous for many of the things that we seem to have forgotten to build for ourselves. And I think that idea that that we're reclaiming some opportunities in our city, that we're using our city as a kind of canvas to paint our aspirations upon for the sort of celebration of urban life that the city's never really seen before. We've well moved beyond our teenage years of thinking of ourselves as a country town to a very mature approach to how we creatively use urban spaces to make a better life for ourselves.
And what about this idea of things that are permanent and timeless versus something that is transient and temporary? How has those values changed?
I'd like to think that it's not an either-or. I think it's very much an and. The city's a complex living organism. It's made of layers and layers and layers of our history. And in this country, they go back tens of thousands of years. But I think that the exciting idea about temporary and spontaneous occupation or celebration of our urban spaces as a kind of another layer of our of the way that we think about our cities, I think that's a very fresh and exciting place to be kind of putting our creative forces. And it really goes to this idea that the city is not just something that that has to be handed to us from the bureaucrats. The city is our city, and it's a thing that we all can lay claim to and shape in our own vision.
I feel terribly enthused right now listening to you talk, Peter Edwards. Matthew Tobin and Amy Gray, of course, are my guests as well. Listening to Peter speak, Matthew, I mean, what do you think? This idea that we can all be city makers, that we can be placemakers as well through our own interventions, no matter how small.
Most definitely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think the value is the idea. and people can deliver an idea in lots of different ways. There's a great artist called Joshua Allen Harris who makes plastic bag dogs out of garbage bags. And he puts them over the grates to the subways in New York, and they self-inflate when a when a train passes underneath. And they're terribly engaging. But if you walk down a New York street at night, they're full up with, you know, garbage bags exploding with rubbish, waiting for the trash collectors to come along and collect them. And then you come across a tree grate with a dog that self-inflates and in front of you as a train passes underneath.
And so the idea is that you're surprised and you can see how someone, an individual, has made an impact, I suppose, in how you walk down that street. How do you then do it? Because the works that you do, I mean, we're talking about permanent and temporary here. The works that you do go into large spaces, some of them, and they're there to stay for quite some time. What's your approach?
So often it's the most exciting artists we work with. They're experimenters and they're innovators. So they test their ideas in a temporary nature before it becomes permanent. We've just done a kinetic screen with an artist called Ned Kahn in Brisbane for it's 5,000 square metres of kinetic panels that when they blow in the wind, the screen to the building looks like rippling water. And Ned started investigating the idea of how to capture the beauty of wind. He comes from the Midwest in America, and the idea that he wanted to capture the movement of the wind across the cornfields. And so his first kinetic screen was made out of string and paper and cardboard and hung in front of an open window. But now he does screens that cost multi-million dollars to make and install, and
But the principle is still the same, isn't it? That it's that moment where you stop and look, whether it's the million-dollar one or the DIY one. Yeah,
the paper one is just as engaging as the huge one.
Amy Gray, I mean, do you see yourself as a city maker? Listening to what Peter and Matthew have to say as well, is that our job, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. The people are their city, so people should contribute to their city and the spaces they're in. And I'm very passionate about public spaces, and public spaces for me are for the people, so they should be a reflection of the people, and the people should be very much involved in their process.
Okay, so in recent years, you've actually gone about transforming some of these public spaces, these ones that sort of, I suppose, for temporary installations, whether it's Parking Bay in Brisbane or other kinds of things. So what led you to steer your design practice in that direction?
Well, I guess it started with graduating university and just being quite frustrated with the whole urban design process, and sort of noticing that by the time there is an outcome from the design, the community is quite disconnected from the process. So I saw these temporary activations as a way to include the community in terms of experimenting with the space and adding things. And for me, it did start with Parking Day, which I started in Brisbane with Yen. And Parking Day happens all over the world. It's a pop-up parks in car spaces. Started in San Francisco, and it was very, very popular in Brisbane. And it's actually then inspired some more permanent work and more temporary work. Earlier this year, we worked with Brisbane City Council to create a park in Albert Street. So we closed down part of Albert Street in the city and for 3 days transformed it into a park. And council used that as a community consultation tool to get people to bring their ideas about how they wanted this to see their city transformed. And it was great because the community could then see what could potentially happen and then made recommendations. And one of them was, we want to see more things like this. And Albert Street already has some opportunities in the future now to cut
it. But what is it about, Amy, about these kinds? I mean, that temporary space, anybody could go to the council at any time, for example, and talk about the things that they wanted for their city. What was it about having that pop-up space that enabled people to communicate better, I suppose?
You have to see it sometimes. People don't know what they want until they sort of see it. But it also enabled the community to manipulate the environment when it was there. Nothing was concreted down, nothing was bolted in. So there was no reason why people couldn't move a seat from a really sunny spot to a shady spot. And there was great opportunities to do that within that space.
Okay, the other project that you've done is called Containerville, which is like it's a pop-up festival out of shipping containers. Is that right?
That's right, yeah, Containerville. It's actually just happening right now. It's under construction and it opens on Saturday. So we have shipping containers down in the old port site at Hamilton, and that site in the near future will be developed for units and retail and commercial spaces. But for now, we wanted to activate it and bring people to the space, but also to see what they wanted. So these retail spaces that are popping up in the containers will encourage people, you know, if they don't like it, then that retail space goes away and we find another one that people like. And, you know, there's been some interesting opportunities with the medium of the shipping containers. And being on the river, this space at Hamilton, and, you know, being an export, it's quite windy. So the containers were a great medium. But in a couple of years' time, if it gets developed, we can actually just then move those retail spaces to somewhere else later on.
And so this idea, though, if a business idea doesn't work, that you can just change it and do something else, I suppose it creates a bit of fluidity and flexibility in what actually happens in these containers. Is that right?
That's right, exactly. And it influences the development for the better. It helps the retailers work out what needs to be done. The community has a say. They sort of vote with their feet. They vote by doing interacting. If it's popular, it continues. If it's not, it doesn't.
Okay. What do you think, Peter Edwards, just to bring you back in here as well? I mean, obviously, pop-ups, we've been talking a bit about that. Shipping containers are now a worldwide phenomenon. It's certainly not a new idea that that can be used in these kinds of environments. Why have they had so much traction, I suppose?
Oh, look, they've had an enormous amount of traction, and it's a terrific example in Christchurch. The reason that containers, I think, are so appealing is that they're incredibly transportable. So they dovetail well with that notion of temporary occupation. But they're under deadly threat of becoming kind of slightly stylized now. I notice in our little Brisbane city context, there's a little restaurant that's popped up that has done a faux container to simulate being a container pop-up. I think what we will see very much, that space of creative temporary occupation will continue to be a lively space, a space where there's a lot of interesting innovation and a lot of any of the cities in Australia, a lot of our cities' creatives can come to that space and really innovate. And I think that's enormously refreshing, because whenever anything is under deadly threat of becoming a pastiche or stale, it's going to be renewed. And it's renewed not because necessarily of any of the usual pragmatics that control and constrain significant infrastructure or significant pieces of architecture. They're free from a lot of those constraints to be constantly creative and constantly reinventing themselves.
Mm. Matthew, what do you want to see? I mean, I know that you've done things all over the world, for example, in Redfern Park in Sydney, the University of Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. I imagine there are many different types of approaches to whether it's a public park or a laneway. But what do you want to see when it comes to these spaces, the pop-up, transient or otherwise?
I think just continuous regeneration and engagement. The trick about making public spaces successful is making sure that people want to inhabit them. And the reasons why people want to inhabit public spaces change depending on the space it is, whether it's a suburban park or an inner city square, the time of day, the time of year.
The weather,
you know. So the puzzle we all need to put together is providing the elements that allow us to make these public spaces that where people want to be. And sometimes that means, from an art point of view, it means a festival of inflatable artworks. Other times it's a permanent art piece. And permanent art pieces like Fiona Foley's piece, Bibles and Bullets at Redfern Park, at different times during the day, it's interacted with in different ways. It has a series of elements in the shape of a cross, and with a water feature in amongst it. And on a hot summer's day, it's covered with screaming kids. but in at the end of a winter's day, it might have one or two people wandering around it, considering the art for the message that it sends.
Okay. And how about for you, Amy? I mean, of course, the container Vaal, not container Vil, although I like that idea. What's your favourite temporary activation? I mean, and you can suggest anything, anywhere in the world.
I really love, there's a project called the Red Swing Project, and it's very, very simple. It's a guerrilla-style pop-up anyone can do. Essentially, you create a swing, you paint it red, and you put it anywhere that you feel there should be one. And it encourages people to positively impact underutilised public spaces. But it also reminds us as adults that we can have fun too, and you should be able to just get on a swing and swing anywhere.
Matthew, do you have a favourite temporary activation anywhere in the world? I know you've mentioned a few blow-up animals, dogs, yeah, out of plastic.
Yeah, probably the thing about inflatables. But Florentine Hoffman, who did the huge inflatable rubber duck in Sydney recently, but it's been in Hong Kong, Shanghai.
And that's coming back for the Sydney Festival, I do believe, yeah, in Parramatta in 2014. Yeah. And Peter Edwards, what about for you?
Well, I'd love to think that when you get in a room with big brains like Matt Tobin, he won't steal your thunder, but he... The delightful work of Joshua Harris, which is internationally famous, it's emulated in cities all over the world, where they're taking advantage of urban situations, like leaving secondhand pianos on the corners of the streets for just people to spontaneously sit down and play, is a terrific example. And I think all of those examples about where urban interventions into public spaces to bring pure delight to an otherwise dreary context, if you can put a smile on a New Yorker's face, I consider it job done.
Well, what a great subject and what a great idea. And thank you so much to our guests today for joining me, Matthew Tobin, Peter Edwards and Amy Gray. You can find links to each of our guests on our website. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
And maybe a question for you, if you're listening right now, do you have a favourite temporary space in your suburb? We would love to hear from you. Links on our website. But that is By Design for today. It's produced by Jan Ryan and Diane Dean. Our sound engineer is Mr. Charlie McEwen. My name is Fenella Kernebone.